Rewind and Digress is a FakeShame.net podcast proudly presented by Viewlorium. Alternative movies, alternative streaming, totally free at Viewlorium.com.
Welcome to Rewind and Digress, where we hit pause on the now and track back to one of our favourite films, hit the road, stop at a highway rest stop, as you know what they're the breeding ground of, take a detour and end up in Mannequin Heaven. I'm Jarrett, and I'm with Glenn and Sean, and we're FakeShemp.net. On this episode, we're rewinding back to 1979 for writer-director David Schmoller's vastly underrated, somewhat subversive, and completely unsettling Tourist Trap. Gentlemen, how you going?
Very well.
I was waiting for a question.
Yeah,
I was still.
All right, well.
Good.
Okay. Yeah. Now that I know that you're great. I want to know about your first experience with Tourist Trap. Now, I'll cut to Glenn first because I have an inkling that maybe this was the first time you saw Tourist Trap.
Yeah, this is the first.
All right, so cut to Glenn. We'll come back to your impression.
Okay. I don't remember where I was when I first saw it. It was just a movie that was always in my bedroom under my bed or something, you know.
Excellent.
Yeah, but I hadn't watched it in a long time. So watching it in preparation for this was like a
trip down memory lane.
Big time.
Really?
But I'd forgotten a lot about it too.
So. Yeah, wow. Was it like, is it, you sort of saw it when you were a kid or a teenager, you reckon? Or?
I would have been, yeah, probably around 10, 11, 12, like around age, most likely. You know, I was getting into this kind of shit back then. And I've written a blog about how Charles Band influenced my taste in horror from a very, very early age when I was like 3 or 4. And so...
Of course, a Ghoulies?
Ghoulies. Oh, yeah.
That poster?
Yeah. No.
The tagline on the poster?
The tagline. The brief story is I was watching it with friends and someone told me the tagline was they'll get you in the end. So I ran all the way home and didn't watch the rest of the movie for years.
Oh, really?
Like, it terrified me the fact that these things would fucking get me.
Yeah.
So Charles Band has been a hero of mine and that's why I owned it.
Just, makes sense.
Yeah.
But this is like next level Charles Band. Like, it's different.
Yeah. So it's like when you say if you compare it against the Troma catalog, it's like looking at Mother's Day even.
Yeah.
It's like that just... really bizarre sort of, but it's produced by Charlie Band. In that instance, Luke Kaufman.
Yeah.
Shauno, what did you... So you, this was the very first time you've seen them?
Yeah, yesterday.
Shauno?
Yeah, Shauno. Yeah.
Just throwing it out there.
Shauno?
Trying it on.
Yesterday was the first time I watched it. I'm going to be honest, never even heard of it before.
Right.
Did you know the poster?
No.
No.
Completely just walked into it blank.
And that's awesome.
I didn't even bother looking at IMDb until I'd finished it. Yeah, so I have 24 hours of history.
Wait, but what's your first memory of it?
Yeah, it's almost. Did you watch it on YouTube on that link I sent you?
I did.
So I watched it on the YouTube link that you sent me as well.
Right.
And I wish the fuck I had a DVD of it.
Oh,
VHS.
Was the transfer not so good on the YouTube?
Not so good.
Not so good. Man.
It was like it was like shot in 8mm and then blown up to 35 or something. Like it was pretty grimy.
Well, if it's any consolation, look, I revisited it on the Blu-ray from 2014.
Have you got the Blu-ray of it?
Of course I've got a Blu-ray.
That's the dumbest question you've ever asked, Jarrett.
Of course I've got. I've got a day bill of this movie. And I also still have it on DVD.
What is the appeal? Because I thought it was absolutely diabolical.
We're going to have this again, are we? Oh,
I hated every single... this was a chore to get through.
Wow.
In fact, it was so bad... that when I looked at the time, like how long it'd been on, and it was 44 minutes into a 90-minute film.
It's a short film.
I was ready to blow my brains out.
You should have watched it on Blu-ray because the quality was better, but it also runs 5 minutes shorter. So it would have only had 41 minutes to go.
And I stuck with it for another 15 minutes, and then I stopped and I went off and made dinner. I read some of my... because I'm just
you
can't stick
like
with this
in
any longer.
Of terror? You didn't carrying under a blanket or anything?
I thought it was absolutely abhorrent.
Right.
I wish this was a vodka so you could see my reaction.
I know.
I have nothing.
He's stifling in his chair here.
Incredible.
So what is the appeal? Like, well, from both of you.
I've got a whole
podcast
about it. So prepare to, you know, get ready. I'm going to sell the film to you. I don't know if it's going to make you ever watch the movie again.
Well, before you do, let me just say, it's got that Charles Band stamp all over it, and that's the appeal for me.
Yeah, I mean, it does.
But it's terrifying too. It's fucking scary.
It's creepy as fuck.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe you've got a
Maybe you've grown up around mannequins. And yeah, but like, I generally find them quite creepy, really? Except when they're Kim Cattrall in Mannequin.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was that. You know, but yeah. Like, no. No.
No?
No.
All right. Well, look, I'll tell you about the first time I saw it. I don't remember. It was on VHS. My old man, I think we rented it out shortly after we moved to Queensland from Melbourne. I think it would have been about 6 at the time. And I think my old man, I think he had seen it before because he was quite keen to get it. My old man rarely wants to re-rent things he's seen previous if it wasn't amazing, if it wasn't The Evil Dead, say, yeah. Or Shawshank Redemption. So we rented it out, and as a six-year-old, I loved it, and I've grown up with it ever since. And it was always easy to get him back to watch that movie again. Could have been because Chuck Connors was in it, and he might have grown up with like the westerns on TV with Chuck Connors. So that was like when I first saw it. But that's not my favorite. I'm going to tell you my favorite memory of seeing this film.
Yep.
Is 2011. I got to see this film on 35mm at an all-night horror movie marathon in Santa Monica at the Aero Theater where Donnie Darko and Sleepwalkers were shot, like scenes nice. Were shot there. It was an all-night marathon that opened with Pet Sematary, throwback yep. to a previous, sort of Rewind and Digress.
Yep.
Second film, Tourist Trap, amazing. And then the whatever the local power company was started to threaten the cinema. They were going to shut the power down, like that grid, a couple streets, blocks yep. or whatnot. Apparently the cinema was well aware and had been protesting it right up until that evening. And basically they had to come in and say, you know, we promised you Dusk Till Dawn movies. Well, no more movies. So it was heartbreaking, but I did get to see Tourist Trap on the big screen.
What did you miss? What was the one you missed?
There was The Pit.
Oh, really?
What else is it? The original Child's Play.
Who did The Pit? That's someone notable.
No, not The Dead Pit. Not the guy, the one that did Virtuosity. Was that Andrew Davis? Yeah, that's the guy that did like Hideaway and stuff. Not that guy. This was the other Pit movie. The really weird one with the kid where he calls them Trogs, I think, the Troglodytes, and he feeds them.
Yes, I know that
Yeah,
one.
I know, you know, I know, people. Yeah, I know yeah. that one. Yeah.
It's a cool little film. I think the original Child's Play, it might have been either that or the original Fright Night. But they're all on 35. It would have been amazing. They're handing energy drinks out. So my stomach could tolerate
anything. That's awesome. It's not your typical marathon.
It was so good. And they had little bits in between every movie where it was like they'd cut together stuff like little internet memes. Like, you know, I don't know what is it. Is it like a gopher or something that's standing up there going, Steve, yeah. Alan, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then like, you know, just all that
random,
kind of random cool in between movies.
It sounds like the Alamo draft.
Yeah, house. Totally. It was like Alamo, but a little less pretentious. Yeah.
Right.
Because the crowd were kind of, you know, totally grindhousey. That's what I'm looking for. But the seats were pretty uncomfortable. I think the Astor Theatre here in Melbourne. That's prior to they've done renos over the years because I went back there last year for a Sleepwalkers reunion screening. But yeah, it was super uncomfortable, and I remember Danny saying, because Danny was with me, she was like, oh, I don't think I can do another couple movies.
Another three films?
Well, there's only another 9 hours to go. I was like, we should have brought pillows. So I think she was pretty happy that they shut it down. But I did get to see on 35, which was a hell of a treat. And there was obviously people that were watching it for the very first time there. And they were,
did they walk out of it as well?
They were laughing at times, at maybe bits that I didn't find funny.
Yeah.
You know, but it was just great to see it with a bunch of genre fans on the big screen.
Join us for the next episode of Rewind and Digress, where Jared and I talk about movies.
We'll be covering Deadpool 2.
Yeah.
All right. So, look, I'll just give anyone listening that hasn't seen the film the synopsis. This is off the back of the 88 films release, the UK release. And this is what it says. It says, an eerie and deserted wax museum, Slauson's lost oasis. Not really a wax museum, though.
And it's not really eerie, either.
I'd say it's eerie. It's
incredibly
definitely
eerie.
Definitely eerie.
Is it?
But they're not wax. They're like, what do they call those mechanized sort of...
they're kind of ceramic. They're kind of ceramic because they kind of shatter and stuff.
Yeah. I guess sculpted. Yeah. Anyway. Slauson's Lost Oasis is the site for spine-tingling terror where four unsuspecting young travellers, including Tanya Roberts from Charlie's Angels and A View to Kill, are lured into a very deadly tourist trap. Slauson, Chuck Connors from Soylent Green, is a reclusive and bizarre owner of this attraction, which is actually more like a macabre chamber of horrors. The grotesque and frightening mannequins in this sordid sideshow are only the beginning of the murderous mayhem and nightmarish madness to come. That's a pretty reasonable explanation.
Yeah.
And you know, it wasn't until I watched it again last night, having had such a distance between my viewings, that I realised how bloody influenced House of a Thousand Corpses was for this one.
Oh, totally.
Because I originally thought House of a Thousand Corpses, it's all Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but no, it's like it's completely this, which obviously is also influenced by Chainsaw Massacre, but hell, this is like Rob Zombie territory.
Absolutely, yeah. It's like a slightly tidier white trash movie.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Did I watch the same film?
You did.
Did you watch the one with the mannequins, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, I'm just making sure.
The one I sent you the link for.
The main...
I was actually genuinely worried he may have watched the wrong movie.
No, but like where the main, I guess, mannequin character is very similar to Leatherface from Next Generation.
Yeah, that was the one. And that was the one, from my mind, that was the one redeeming sequence.
You didn't find that incredibly chilling, like watching that image?
No.
I did.
Oh, wow.
It was the one part that I found tolerable in the film is when he's down in the basement and he's like, my brother doesn't. Sequence, you know, where he's like,
where he's Davey.
And he drops the key and the guy tries to get it with his foot and he can't, and he's speaking all this weird, style. I'm like, okay, like this is okay. Like if we get more of this will be good. And then it stopped and I'm like, okay, we're back to nothing again.
Well, look, in defense of Sean, it's a very jarring film in sense of the style switches a lot. From that Charles Band quirkiness to that Toby Hooper terror. Does bounce very it's very abrupt. It's strange, sharp.
You kind of have that backwards type horror film and then you've also got this very sort of Silence of the Lambs kind of almost weird sort of.
But even then I felt like, and you guys will obviously disagree, but I felt like that weird backwoodsy thing, I'm just like, okay, like we've seen, like how many times have we seen this? We've seen this 100,000 times. And then
this is the precursor to a lot of those.
It's just
films.
Like the characters have nothing to do. They're just searching for things to do. Like, you know, we're just watching them do nothing.
Get that little Jeep repaired and head home.
Other than Chainsaw Massacre, there wasn't a lot of this kind of story around at the time. Like you had The Hills Have Eyes, I suppose.
Yeah.
But this was still a very sort of new kind of thing.
Maybe that's what I'm missing. Maybe I'm missing context. So perhaps what is the context of the film?
Well, this film was released in 79, but I believe it was shot around 77. So probably around the same time as Hills Have Eyes, you know, post Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah.
I forgot how old it is. 79.
Yeah, and it was theatrically released in 79.
So that just solidifies
I had a bit of
my point.
Distribution
there
issues.
There wasn't much like it at the time.
Yeah.
No, it really, predated a lot of the films, like even the slasher films that would have come out. Like, we'll touch on themes later, but obviously one of the themes is, you know, if you have sex, you'll get killed, which kind of was more established with Halloween, but this film should have come out before Halloween. You know, it was made for Halloween, and it was the same distributor.
It had no knowledge of Halloween when I was
Yeah,
that's true. Because when was Halloween? 77?
78, sorry. Yeah, 78.
Right, gotcha.
But yeah, this shot before, and then Compass International distributed both films, but Compass International pushed Halloween out to audiences first. But yeah, look, casting, we mentioned Chuck Connors before, plays Mr. Slauson. He was famous for westerns throughout the 50s and 60s TV.
Yeah, he was one of the
big ones.
The boys. The he was man. One. Yeah.
He was in Branded too, another short run sort of western series that was actually created by Larry Cohen.
Yeah, right.
Interestingly enough, and Glenn, I guess you might know him well from Old Yeller from the Disney film. but yeah, look, he just nails the role, I think, because he was trying to do something against type for him. You know, he'd long played those roles and obviously he'd gotten too old for those roles. So he wanted to do something a little different. So he didn't leave the cowboy hat too far, though, because I think he walks in, the first time you see him walk into this movie, he's wearing a cowboy
hat.
He's got
a swagger.
And a rifle. And you're like, oh, okay.
I can't think of too many examples, but I know they exist. But that era, there was a lot of these classic actors coming into these really weird, surreal horror films. Yeah. Like, what's the chick in Forbidden Zone? Oh, I can't remember her name, but that, you know, the older woman that gets her tits out.
Oh, I was going to say the larger lady. Not that one.
Anyway, she was a very credible sort of Hollywood starlet in her time, and she came and did that. And then I guess
Donald Pleasence in Halloween.
Yeah, but I'm talking really quirky ones.
For example,
even the cook in Chainsaw Massacre, like he was a stage thespian before this, and now all of a sudden is this zany character. But that era was full of those kind of moments where older actors that have sort of left the scene
are looking to reinvent themselves.
Yeah, and they came back in weird ways like this.
Yeah. Well, Chuck Connors, he's got two roles in the film. Like, there's that whole duality between playing Slauson, but then also playing the Davey character. And something I want to touch on again, I guess I'm racing ahead about themes, is that it's unusual, but looking at the film now, obviously you've got that whole, you know, you've got the transvestite character in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I say transvestite because he's definitely more feminine.
Yeah.
Whereas this character, it's really odd when he puts the Davy outfit on, he can be feminine or he can be a man. He's got one of the mannequin masks with the sideburns. It's almost like he's like this kind of...
And the top hat.
You know, in the top... Yeah, in the top hat. It's like he's like kind of like a non-binary villain. It's kind of weird.
He is.
You know,
he
like
adopts this, the persona.
Isn't it weird, the gender neutrality thing? But it was like an odd thing. But yeah, no, it's a strange... It's kind of this strange non-binary killer role. And also, you know, it's not totally a slasher. It's like a cross slasher backwards type, you know, movie. But you've got a killer that actually talks as well. And supernatural, obviously, as well. Yeah. But he talks.
Weird dialogue. You know, weird dialogue.
Very strange.
Yeah, it is weird dialogue.
Oh, little girl. And things like that.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, it's so odd. Like, Chuck Connors did an incredible job with this role. Who would have thought? You know, and he still plays the nice guy. Like, he can really identify with the Slauson character. Mm. And the Davy character is just hell creepy. we mentioned before that Tanya Roberts is in it. She went on to Charlie's Angel, View to Kill. One of that's my favourites, Don Coscarelli's The Beastmaster. She was in.
Wasn't she the bimbo in that 70s show?
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. The mother, was it?
Yeah, she was like the next door neighbour's, the girlfriend's mum.
Yeah. And yeah, she was like pretty much in that entire series.
Yeah, she was just a complete diss. She did it so well. Like, she was hilarious.
Did you notice who edited the film?
No.
Ted Nicolau, who was the director of Bad Channels, Magic in the Water, wow. Terrorvision, and Subspecies.
Oh, really?
So he was on the Full Moon roster
for there. The Empire and Full Moon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he edited this one. This is obviously where he got his kickstart with the company.
Who scored it? Because the score was quite worthwhile.
Weirdly mismatched, but in a good way.
It works. Oddly jarring.
It's a weird juxtaposition, the two. Pino Danaggio, who did, De Palma films.
I know the name. I wouldn't be able to put the title.
He actually did the score for the Patrick remake.
Did he?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did he really?
Yeah, isn't that weird?
There you go.
We were just talking about off air. But yeah, the score, fuck, I love the score. It's like really whimsical and unsettling. It's so strange and offbeat. And because you hear those opening notes of the score right at the beginning of the film, it really sort of sets the scene.
It's the opening that really makes it. It jars you right from the get-go.
It is. It's totally is.
And actually, there's a scene towards the start, which I found hilarious, where they're sort of skinny dipping in the lake.
Yes.
And I want to get your perspective, having seen it in sort of a better definition than what we did.
You've seen nothing. Seen nothing.
No, I'm not.
All right, okay.
That's what you're focused on.
No, it's in high def.
Get your head out the gutter, dude.
If you look at it, like, it pans out, and you got this scene of sort of a dry, arid land with this, like, fake grass and fake plastic trees and fake moss and shit like that, and it's the most...
It's paradise.
It's the most absurd scene ever. And then you've got that music over it, which is just making it this... That's it.
If you can only see my hands right now, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm operating some strange...
I thought you were conducting.
I am conducting.
But it does feel good.
Crazy score, actually. It's good that you brought that up, because, you know, Pino's a famous artist, and in this point in his career, he's been doing De Palma films, been doing big films, and they kind of just lucked out getting him. He was in the States to do the score for Piranha.
Yeah, right.
Because Joe couldn't speak Italian, and David was, spoke Italian and English fluently. He acted as an interpreter for the two, so helped, you know, Joe work with Pino on Piranha. And he kind of spoke to him about doing this film.
Yep.
The only thing was, the budget of this film was $300,000, but he agreed to do the film for $50,000. So a seventh of the budget is actually the score for the film. And Charlie Band brokered the deal, and he ended up doing the score for the film. So the 50 grand included, you know, composition, all the, you know, artists to perform the music and that. But they lucked out with it. I mean, it's one of those standout features. It's a really creepy
score.
It
absolutely is, yeah.
It's one of those ones, like, I do get a lot of scores on vinyl. Mm. And as much as I love that score, I just don't think I could listen to it without the film, because it's just too wacky. It's like, I've got Greasy Strangler on vinyl.
Yeah.
And putting it on, it's you know, it's fine to listen to one track, but when you listen to the whole soundtrack... And
I agree.
Without the visuals, it's just too
going back to another fiction podcast, the Candyman one, it's the same thing. Like, I'll listen to Philip Glass's score, but I get... And it can... contextually inside the film, it makes the film like much deeper, richer, all that, but I can't get through 6 minutes of it and listening to my headphones. It just doesn't
without the film. Some of these scores just don't work. And if they're particularly wacky like this one, so I've held off buying it. I mean, it looks fantastic, like it's amazing artwork, and I'll probably, if I pick it up cheap one day, I'll just bite the bullet and it'll just sit on the shelf. It's not like it'll lose value, because I'm sure there's a lot of diehard fans out there like me that, you know, if I choose to part with it. Going back to casting, I'm going to mention it's probably more production design, because, I mean, you don't really cast a car, but a fucking interesting choice of car that I only noticed for the very first time going back and watching this.
Yeah.
The little Jeep at the start. Yeah. Did you know what that is? It's a Volkswagen thing. You watched...
It was on Jerry Seinfeld. Yes.
I'm getting comedians in car, getting coffee with Zach Galifianakis.
Yes.
He goes and picks him up in the Volkswagen thing. So I had seen this thing over time, but I had not realized it was a thing. And then when I watched Tourist Trap, I'm like, you got to be fucking kidding. I just watched that episode a couple of weeks back.
Yeah.
If anyone that doesn't know what this vehicle is, it's a recreational vehicle you could use to take to the beach or on the adventures or whatnot, but it's actually from World War II. It was like...
Oh, German Nazi. You
know, Nazi transportation. Yeah. So it's a pretty handsome vehicle. Like, it is cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, it's a retro cool.
Yeah.
You know, they sort of talked it down on the Seinfeld program, but it did actually, they manufactured it from 68 through to about 83.
Yeah.
You know, into the US. So, I mean, that's pretty cool.
It was bigger than what they
run. It was a market for
pretty good
it.
Run. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, anyway, so I just thought that was interesting. I'd touch on that. Trivia, Jack Palance was actually considered for the role.
And I can see that.
Yeah.
The director actually met with Jack to do it, and they spoke about it, but then he ultimately turned it down. So,
he had issues with lots of movies that he's turned down. He had big bone of contention with Natural Born Killers.
Right.
He was originally going to be Tommy Lee Jones's character and pulled out at late notice just because of the content. It's like, did you read the script? Did you get?
Which is weird because Jack Palance was always in violent films.
Yes,
like,
he was.
You know, when he was budging over to Italy and all that.
And like not long after this one came out, he did Alone in the Dark.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Super violent. Yeah. But what a cast. Yeah. Jesus. Martin Landau, Donald Pleasance.
Yeah.
Fantastic cast. That would be a great one to revisit sooner or later.
Totally.
Another little bit of trivia, because I like to bring up the bits of trivia that I gather from the audio commentary that you don't read on IMDb, that this generally isn't on a Wikipedia
and that
page.
We wouldn't know, because we don't listen to this commentary.
Exactly. Well, Sean's definitely not going to know any of this.
I'm interested to hear the trivia, though.
Finding out these factoids gives him a deeper appreciation of the film. He goes, fuck, maybe it is all right.
Maybe it is. Yeah, I'm going to have to try.
Could have had Jack Palance in it. Maybe it would have been better. But
maybe the big
mistake
was YouTube.
Maybe the big mistake's just with me. There obviously seems to be a big market for it. There obviously seems to be a big fan base.
Well, that's the funny thing. Like, it's one of those sort of horror films I grew up with that, you know, when you talk to other horror fans, maybe they'd heard of it. It was pretty obscure until it kind of came out in DVD and found an audience again. But I found an article on the internet was really interesting about how the film's it's been a cult film but never really found a massive fan base until now. And they said, like, in the last 5 years or so, this film is really popular with millennials.
Yeah.
And I read the whole article, blew my mind.
Exactly what Fred Decker was saying on that Mick Garris interview about Monster Squad.
That's true.
Night of Creeps. He had no idea for 20 years that there was an audience for this.
Yeah.
Crazy, isn't it? Crazy.
So your trivia.
Okay, so the at the start where you've got all the... I want to call them something else. What do they call those robots? Like the ones in Hugo? Automatons?
Yeah, the kind of automatons.
Yeah.
Westworld.
Kind of like that. Yeah, totally like that. Anyway, they were all mimes. They hired mimes to play the role.
There are scenes where you can see that.
Yeah, you can see
that. When he fires the gun, you can see the arm movement.
Which is cool and really unsettling.
I really enjoyed that, though, because it kind of it plays into that supernatural element that was alluded to within the characters.
Buckets is a surreal movie. It's just such a bizarre and unsettling film. I know you've only seen it once, Sean, but was there any standout scenes for you?
Well, like I said, the one in the basement where he's talking. I wish I could remember the dialogue, but it was the one time in the film where I'm like, okay, this is interesting. Like, this has got interesting now.
Yeah.
You know, this guy, the mask.
It's interesting too, because it's like the real time, first time you really hear Davey talk properly.
Yeah. And the thing, you know, he's talking like he owns this situation, but it looks like he's being owned, like he's being kept downstairs, locked away.
Yeah,
but
he's always like, my brother.
He's always like, you know, my brother doesn't, you know, like me doing these things. And, you know, like, he's, you know, like, you know, he's smart enough to kill, but he's not smart enough to be upstairs. Like, it's this kind of weird. Mm. And that was those kind of weird juxtapositions. That was the first time I thought, oh, okay, like, this is, we're
but
starting
he's,
to
I guess
touch
he's
on,
schizophrenic. You know, he's kind of these two people.
Yeah. I mean, by that time, you don't realize it, though.
No, of course. Actually, because, that's the weirdest thing. Rewatching it this time, I was like, when Tanya Roberts jumps back into the car with Thorsten later, you're like, what the fuck are you doing? And you're like, oh, that's right. She doesn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm like, did you know? Like, was it really obvious? Surely, that's it's obvious that it's. The
I was
going to
say
pretty early in the piece.
It did strike my mind. It didn't come as much of a surprise.
We're a much savvier audience these days. Yeah. Back then, I don't think people would have clued on quite as much.
Yeah. I don't know because I just don't. I don't remember what I thought as a kid.
Like the audience for Psycho wouldn't have seen it coming. You know, the kind of thing where your mind wasn't in that place.
Yeah.
That's how I would see it.
Interesting. What about you, Glenn? Any particular favourite scenes?
It's not really favourite scenes. I mean, they're all
pretty
creepy.
It's a bit of a weird one.
But what strikes me about this one is, I will agree with Sean, it's a very slow burn kind of film. Mm. Like, it does meander and it takes a long time to get to its point.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, they just wrap it up at the end. They just kill him and they're in the car and off they go.
Pretty good death scene. But that final shot when she's driving off.
Yeah, but it's just like the movie, it's going, it stops.
Yeah.
Like, they just kill him and then off she goes. And she drives away in the thing with all the mannequins of her friends.
All the friends. It's such a good shot. And she just looks so like fucking deranged, changed forever.
And that's the classic trope, I guess, of those movies. It's always that getaway shot, you know? Chainsaw Massacre did it. And all this
good shit. Freeze frame at the end, roll credits.
I wouldn't say it's a good freeze frame. But
no, it's pretty fucking
it's a
grainy.
Freeze frame.
But they got it somewhat. It looks pretty in focus.
Yeah.
They really pulled focus fast.
Well, not on YouTube. There's no focus in the whole film.
Looking at that shot, because I'm like, geez, that's a tight shot.
Yeah, it was appalling on YouTube.
Was it really that bad?
It was like watching it with Vaseline on your glasses. Like,
it was like watching it hammered drunk, trying to stay awake at 3 a.m.
Oh, shit, I'm really sorry. I should have worked out another way for you guys to watch it.
You probably saw the YouTube link on your phone and it looked really nice and tight.
Yeah, I think I must have looked at it and it was so small. I was like, geez, that looks tight. Yeah. Send that to the boys. Was it at least in widescreen or was it in 4:3?
No, it was in widescreen.
How old is that?
But I'm watching on. I've got a 72-inch. Yeah. So I'm watching on a 72-inch. Yeah. Yeah.
Same. Like, it was huge.
Yeah, it would be unforgiving.
It was. To say the least.
It made me want to buy the Blu-ray.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah. Well,
but I have fond memories of it. Yeah. So.
I will actually discuss a little bit about the Blu-ray when we wrap it up. But I just want to tell you my favorite scene. My favorite scene's when Davey's pursuing Molly through the woods. And he's got the severed head of Woody.
Oh, yeah.
And he just raises it up and it just goes, Molly! Fucking terrifying moment. Because it still fucks with me. Because I'm like, is he a ventriloquist? What is this? This is supernatural. It's just super surreal.
Yeah.
And I still can't quite make my mind up. I'm like, obviously there's an element. Or is it in his head? Like, Tanya Roberts, when the mannequins are falling on her, she sees them crowd her and move around and shuffle. And it's just too much going on.
I actually burst out laughing when all the mannequins fell on her.
I really like that moment.
And she, you know, she's like all dazed and confused. I actually burst out laughing. I'm like, is that all it's going to take? Like,
yeah.
You know, I don't often call for remakes, but I think this would serve very well as a remake.
I agree.
I think, you know, with the right director. Maybe, who did the Maniac remake?
Oh, Alexandra the P2 guy.
Oh,
Frank, something.
That guy, give this film that sensibility in a remake, and I think you're on a winner.
I want to see. Actually, it's funny you do mention Maniac, because this predates Maniac, and you have that whole interplay with the mannequins, and even toward the end when, you know, he's axed.
Yeah.
He has a great death scene.
Yeah.
Like, his death scene's great. On the commentary track, they weren't quite sure how he was going to do it, because they hadn't really rehearsed it. And so he did it, and they managed to get it all in the one take and
stayed
on him. And it's a great death scene. Like, it's actually really quite convincing. But with the mannequin sort of surrounding, it's very, you know, Maniac finale as such.
Do you know, I've never seen Maniac.
Wow, you're in for a treat when you do.
Never. I haven't seen either one of them.
Yeah,
it's a strange movie.
The remake's solid too.
Oh, this remake. I
hear the remake
like the
is
remake
really good.
Better than the original, but they're very different.
It's got a lot of. Yeah. It's got the repeat value. The remake, like, you can go back to it.
Totally.
Very clever.
Yeah.
And it's different.
The first one's very. It'll be weird you watching it now too, with the climate of cinema and everything that's transpired in the 40 odd years since it's been made, 38 years, because it's very misogynist.
Oh. Yeah,
it's
hell yes.
very.
It's all about
sleazy.
A guy who can't pull chicks, and he goes and murders chicks.
And
know?
Yeah, and he falsifies who he is.
Yeah.
Like, he's very fraudulent
as a
fashion photographer.
Yeah,
he's got like these mummy issues, and it's just. It's
but that
really
all that all exists in the remake too, and that's contemporary.
Yeah, it's somewhat. Yeah, I don't know. There's a class about the remake. I don't know.
It's all
the
first
one's very
first
sleazy.
Point of view, first person point of view. The
remake.
Yeah.
So I hear, yeah.
Which is like, yeah, I saw it at MIF and I didn't know that going in. So I was like, oh, if I'd known this device, would have I been here as fast, but then I left the cinema.
But then you realize it actually is Elijah Wood, because when he looks in the mirror, it's very clever.
Because the other point of view one that I watched was Hardcore Henry.
I still haven't seen that.
Oh, that's torturous.
Trial. That's a trial.
It's a shame,
I enjoyed it, but it's arduous. It's very arduous.
Yeah. I mean, like, the short that it was based on, that 10-minute short that did the rounds, I mean, holy moly, that's... But it doesn't work pulled out to 80,
it would work if you had
minutes.
A VR.
Like,
yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. So the writer-director, David Schmoller, he was the screenwriter and director responsible for the first Puppet Master film, for Charlie Band's 1989 Puppet Master.
Which is quite good.
Yeah, no, it definitely has its merits, and it has that
But you
old
can
guy
see Puppet Master
like
in this.
Well, see, that's what I was going to say.
That old guy from Forget Paris and from
what's his
Monkey
name?
Trouble.
Yeah.
I
don't know.
He plays, was it Dorian or whatever his name is? The
you
character?
Got
Dorian
it.
Or something.
Boy, old guy.
See, because when I think of Charles Band... Puppet Master is a thing I think of.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right? And there's just some disconnect where I can't see the similarities between this in Charles Band's catalog.
Well, if you look at some of the Empire stuff, I mean, it all is pretty similar, with the exception of maybe this movie. Because, yeah, look, there's not a great deal of humor in Tourist Trap, as opposed to a lot of the other Charlie Band Empire stuff or Full Moon. There's
heaps. I reckon there's heaps.
I think there's a subversive sort of sense of humor about it, but I think some of the more of the other Empire
it has got gags.
That stuff's a bit more blatant. So I guess that's the kind of
it's a film you can pinpoint. This is like the origin of where Charles Brand took his brand.
Yeah,
you know, because of the whole the puppet thing turned, or the mannequin thing turns into puppets. You know, with Puppet Master and then he did like Bad Channels and
Doll Man.
Like he's fascinated by this I guess toyish kind of childlike atmosphere. And that's the thing that's scary about this one, is that the mannequins, like, they're very toyish, they're like little China dolls, you know.
Totally,
you know, there's a lot of innocent. Speaking of like kid friendly, it's got a PG rating.
Well, common mistake, but yes, PG in the States,
which
that's
is what
why
I mean.
They think sank it, you know, because people wanted to see R-rated horror. But the weird thing is, though, I am convinced to this present day, because yes, I've checked the classification board, it was passed as an M for theatrical and M for home video. Daybill says M, but I'm fucking 100% convinced that the actual original video cover actually had the US rating PG on it.
Really? If anyone has got an original R-rated version of Tourist Trap, whack it on the comment section of our Facebook post for this podcast.
Yes, PG rated, or whether it's M, one or the other.
It wouldn't surprise me if it was PG. It really wouldn't.
Yeah, that's
because I don't think.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe they used the US art and it ended up on the Aussie video jacket.
Because PG films can be quite creepy. I give you The Witches, right?
Mm.
For a PG rated film, that conjures a great deal of atmosphere. Mm. It's scary. You know, it's scary for kids. It's even scary for adults. You know, like. So it wouldn't surprise me if this did get a PG, because there's nothing really explicit in it. I agree, but what I'm saying is there's the possibility that it could have been rated a PG.
Well, in America, it definitely would have been.
It definitely was.
And that was because that would have been before the introduction of the PG-13.
And the famous
rating.
Story of Chainsaw Massacre almost being PG if they had have rated it based on what's on screen, but it was the intensity.
The intensity, and this one, I would say maybe the
intensity drove it. Yeah, to you know. Fans thought it was much more
terrifying. The intensity's stuck a problem with horror for the longest time, hasn't it? Because didn't, when Wes Craven did Scream back in 95 and he put it through the ratings board, didn't he have to go through like 14 different cuts or something? And he took out all the blood, and on his last trial, you know, when he went through, that was, you know, what he said. They're going, nah, you got to cut it down. He says, there's nothing left to cut down. I can't. And that's what they say. No, it's not the blood, it's the intensity. You got to cut down the intensity. Yeah. And that's where Scream ended up. So you put the blood back in, try to take out the intensity.
Intensity makes a horror film.
Exactly. That's the best part of it.
That's the strength of a film. That's the strength of a director.
Yeah.
If you can achieve that.
Look at High Tension. That's predicated on that idea.
Also, the director, David Schmoller, he is responsible for one of my favorite Klaus Kinski films from the mid-80s.
Ah, I know the one you mean.
Yes,
Crawl Space.
Yeah. Crawl Space, absolute classic.
I had a Region 4 DVD release of Crawl Space that went for 60 minutes. Whereas what? I look it up, it says like 70 minutes, 80 minutes.
Yeah, it's
something.
A short one. It's yeah, about 70 odd minutes.
I could swear the back of the jacket says 60 minutes.
Because you know what? Like, because the...
Take the credits out and that's probably all it is.
Well, it could be PAL, so it could have sped it up by know, running at 25 frames as opposed to 24, so it would speed the film up.
I assume you don't have the disc anymore?
No.
Right.
It might only be like 72 minutes. So it could have very well fallen down 67 or
I sold that one at the Fitzroy Film Fair.
There you
did
go.
You really?
Yes.
Classic film. Then there's an interesting backstory about the director having worked with Klaus Kinski on how much trouble he was. You know, I mean, he's...
intolerable.
Absolutely. And he made a documentary in, I think it was like 1999, that's on the Crawl Space Blu-ray, the US Blu-ray, but you can actually watch it on YouTube. I'll send you the link.
Please
it
do.
Actually looks all right. I mean, it's not that bad. Runs at about 8 minutes, and it just talks about his experience of having worked with Klaus on the film. It is fucking hilarious. And he's directed it, David the director, and he's on camera talking about the whole experience, and it is hilarious.
Next level.
Yeah, it's really, really funny. Yeah, and I mean, if you're a Klaus Kinski fan, then you should probably read his autobiography, because that's fucking mental as well.
Is it?
It is insane. Everything's super sexualized, and it's just, it's the ramblings of a pure madman.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of great stories about how crazy he is. There's a lot of horrible stories about some potentially awful things that he did, particularly with his children.
Yeah.
But this book is just madness. It's an autobiography, and it's just like how much of it's truth and how much of it's just pure fantasy. I don't know.
Deranged musings.
It's fucking amazing. It sounds it's a stunning read. If they should make that into a movie, they couldn't. It'd be a HBO series, and yeah, I don't know if you could even.
Who would play
HBO?
Klaus Kinski?
Oh dear God, who would you get? Dafoe?
Well, he's already done the.
He's already Shadow of a Vampire.
Yeah,
has to be someone probably a bit with a little bit more youth. Who though?
Yeah,
it's a good question.
It sounds like Joe Esther has his biography, Hollywood Animal. Have you read that?
No.
You know Joe Esther has?
Yeah.
Hollywood Animal.
Yeah. Showgirls?
Next level stuff. Like
that would be a great.
That is off the chain. That like it's a solid book. It's about 700 pages. Hollywood Animal. You can pick it. You can get it in Booktopia or something for $10 or something. But it's so worthwhile. Like the stories this guy tells you. Because he's Hungarian, you know, World War II, and his family fled from, you know, blah, blah, and he talks about all that. And then as soon as he gets to Hollywood, it's bonkers, man. Like, it's
I want to read it. It actually sounds like a solid.
It is, absolutely. Because, I mean, he's obviously famous for Basic Instinct and Showgirls and Jade and all these psychosexual thrillers and the people he was hanging around with and the deals that had to be swung and the cocaine parties and you know how people tried to persuade him, you know, sending around lingerie models, you know, like to deliver handwritten notes from studio executives and like, and that's as mild as it gets. Like it is next.
Hello, me too.
Yeah, it's
it is. God, completely different
level.
Era.
Yeah, next level stuff.
Wow,
bonkers.
There'll never be another era like it.
No.
I guess it's probably time to wrap it up, but I generally talk about the home ent releases in the wrap up. In this instance, I mentioned earlier that there is a Blu-ray release. There's two Blu-ray releases. There's the 88 Films release in the UK, and then there is the Full Moon Entertainment release in the US. Pretty much the same.
Do they have the
same special
cover
features? Yes,
the cover
88
art is cool.
Films has a reversible sleeve, and the reversible sleeve is that really great poster art, uninterrupted. I don't think there's any logos or anything on it. It's terrific. The 88 Films one's at a higher bitrate for the visuals, and in terms of the audio, it's got like a lossless audio track as opposed to lossy audio that is on the Full Moon Entertainment release. They all have the same special features. The 88 Films one has a nice little booklet with notes by Callum Waddell. It's pretty cool, little interesting read. But here's the kicker with both releases. They're both from the same master. Master is 5 minutes shorter than any other version of Tourist Trap that's ever existed. Be it in theatres, video,
YouTube.
DVD. Probably, I'd say YouTube because I reckon that's from the 1999 DVD. The 5 minutes are missing from the film and the director hadn't noticed because he was on his own dime, recorded an audio commentary for it and got an interview recorded. He was just happy to participate with the release.
Does the audio commentary match? Like,
he recorded the commentary to the high def release.
Okay,
so he was unaware until someone brought up the fact that, hang on, this is shorter, you know, run shorter, and this is what's missing.
Thank God.
And that's when he's been told that he probably hadn't watched it for a while, no doubt. And that's when he's gone, well, I'll reach out to Charlie Band and find out, because he looked after it all. And Charlie Band's like, oh, no, no, this is the only version of the film. And then eventually he admitted, oh, well, look, no, it's what we access from the lab. David, do you know any more about it? David's like, I've had nothing to do with the print, man. It's all on you. And he's like, well, look, I can't say, you know, like, maybe something happened in the lab and, you know.
Classic Charlie.
Charlie Band's trying to deny it. But the funny thing, too, is he'd all, like, with all the salesmanship, because he is a salesman, is that, you know, struck from the original negative and all that sort of bullshit.
He's a charlatan. Yeah, he's a charlatan.
He's a huckster.
There's this guy that was, I can't actually remember his name, but the guy that was post-production supervisor at Full Moon Entertainment when they first released Tourist Trap to DVD in 1999 under Cult Video. He's a filmmaker now, but he came out and said, I supervised the transfer back in 99 for the DVD release of Tourist Trap. That was from the original negative, and I've seen the Blu-ray. They're completely different prints.
Oh, yeah.
He goes, this is some international print or one that was prepared for TV.
Yep.
It's film and it's been transferred from 35, sure, but it's not from the original negative. So, you know, Charlie Band's been shot down that it's not from the original negative or whatnot. Who knows where the fuck?
Well, I was
going to
say, then where is the 5 minutes and or where's the original print?
Well, yeah, that's it. Well, his theory about the original print is it perfect Charlie Band story is he thinks that Charlie Band hasn't paid the lab that's holding it,
yep,
and so he can't get it out because he hasn't paid his lab bills. So they're holding it, so he's accessed another print because this is what he can get a hold of. It's weird too because, look, it's missing 5 minutes, but in a roundabout way, it's some scenes are slightly longer in this version, some are shorter, there's slightly alternate shots. So clearly this was like...
Does it affect the outcome of the film, do you reckon?
Absolutely not. Yeah. I don't think... If you don't own this film in any format, you should buy the Blu-ray because it's pretty much the film. It doesn't matter. You're not missing anything. If you don't, if you own the DVD, hold on to the DVD and, you know...
Charles Band does those things and doesn't expect people to catch on. When he did the VHS releases and said they're like authentic, you know...
I found 500, you know, video covers in my bloody warehouse, you know, from the 80s. And I'm going to sell them, but I don't have the tapes.
Yeah, but then that was proven they were all newly photoshopped.
They were all
newly,
like the other one I liked too someone went up to him at like a convention and had sculpted a Ghoulies, you know, statue for him. Check this out, it's a present for you. And Charlie loved it so much that he went and got 500 of them made, replicated, you know, without this guy's permission or anything, consent, and then sold them.
Yeah,
Charlie Band.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he's a mercenary.
And to think he's my horror hero.
He's great, man. Yeah. Like he's like the...
We need charlatans in the film world.
Totally is. He's like Uncle Lloyd, but like Uncle Lloyd...
More shameless.
Uncle Lloyd exploits people,
yeah,
but he's not a crook. Charlie Band's a crook, but I like it. Well, lads, I think that's really it. Shauno, will you be running out and buying the Blu-ray?
Look, probably not,
right?
But I think, you know, this conversation's given me a bit of context and whatnot. I'm going to go back and I'm going to hell or high water try and find a better copy one way or another, revisit it, see if that makes a difference. Maybe watch it by myself with the lights out, you know, see if I can conjure some of that magic.
Crank the sound.
There's obviously something there that I'm not getting. It could be because of the bad transfer.
Yeah.
I doubt it, but I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt. Give it another go and watch this space. I'll get back to you.
Easy.
Good stuff.
Excellent. Well, all right, lads. Quick shout out to the Screaming Meanies who do our intro and outro music. Thank you very much. And if you enjoy the Screaming Meanies music, on Amateur Outro, you can check out his Bandcamp page. And thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.